Our next case is 13-1174, the State of Ohio versus David L. Labor. For the appellant, Mr. Gelliard.
Madam Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, reserve 5 minutes, please. Our society deals with grave, violent realities, and Ohio's terrorist threat statute is aimed to prevent such tragedies. But no law pursues its purpose at all costs, and a law's textual limitations upon its scope are part of its purpose. Linda Lawless was unequivocal that David Labor wondered what it would be like to commit certain violent acts. On the whole, her testimony also demonstrated that Mr. Labor's tone was not hostile or aggressive, and that he was frustrated with his superiors at work. As such, Mr. Labor's expression of wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent acts does not demonstrate the specific intent to intimidate or coerce. The textual...
asked to decide, was he just wondering out loud, or did he have the specific intent to carry out those threats?
The Attorney General's insistence on deferring to the
But what's the jury. Answer to my question? Was that for the jury to decide? The difficulty I'm having with your argument is that you seem to want us to second guess what the jury actually decided.
No. We're asking this court to set parameters on the types of evidence that constitute the specific intent to intimidate coerce. This court has done so at least 3 times in the last 4 or 5 years. In Straley, this court set parameters on the types of evidence that could establish an investigation or criminal proceeding in the tampering with evidence context. Similarly, in Malone, this court did the same thing, but in the witness intimidation context. And finally, in Smith, this court set parameters in the civil protection order context as to what would establish that a civil protection order had issued or been served. That's what Mr. Labor is asking this court to do, to set parameters on the types of evidence that can establish the specific intent to intimidate or coerce.
Counsel, but I guess I'm also still waiting for the answer to Justice French's question. In the first assignment of error at the Court of Appeals, your client was suggesting that the jury verdict was against the manifest weight of the evidence. Was it?
The assignment of error, the Court of Appeals took the assignment of error to be both a manifest weight and a sufficiency challenge. The argument here is, irrespective of what was presented to the jury, the evidence set that through Ms. Lawless's unequivocal statement that David Labor wondered what it would be like to commit certain violent acts, and as such, in this court's review of the sufficiency of that evidence, the parameters are such that an expression of wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent acts does not constitute a threat.
But then he's followed it up, though. I mean, the evidence before the jury was, I wonder what it'd be like, and here's where I would start. At the front office, I'd do this, I'd do that. So it was more than just idle speculation.
All of the specifics that came from Mr. Labor came through probing questions from Ms. Lawless, and they came within the confines of this wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent acts. If this court determines that those specifics took it outside of that context, then Mr. Labor loses. However, Ms. Lawless's testimony, again, is unequivocal, and it locks his statements in. She says explicitly, he's not telling me he's going to do it. He's saying, I wonder what it would be like. So the evidence is such that it's locked within those confines, and it is purely an expression of wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent
but
acts.
But counsel, I guess that still begs the question before us today. Who makes the decision whether or not it's a threat? in our society, isn't that decision made by the jurors who weigh the context of the statements, where they were made, to whom they were made, and how they were made? Are you asking us to depart from that standard?
I'm asking this court to evaluate the elements of the offense. And there are aspects of 2909-23 in A1 that requires the specific intent to intimidate or coerce. And that inherently demonstrates what constitutes a threat. If the jury got it wrong, and what courts do in sufficiency evaluations is make that determination. And we're asking this court to set parameters on the type of evidence that can establish the specific intent to intimidate or coerce, just as this court did in Straley, Malone, and Smith.
Counsel, are you saying that there should have been a directed verdict granted here because as a matter of law, there was insufficient evidence to go to the jury? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes, that's one way to get there. If that was requested at trial, then the trial court should have granted that.
Because the whole point here is we are not a court of error correction. And I heard you say the jury got it wrong. We're here to determine the legal questions and whether there should be a rule of law that's written for other cases as well. So what I think what we're all trying to find out is, what are you arguing is the rule of law that should be written in this case?
The rule of law is an expression of mere wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent acts does not violate Ohio's terrorist threat statute because it does not demonstrate the specific intent to intimidate or coerce required by 2909-23A1A.
Your client said he would shoot Emmett first, didn't he?
Again, all of the specifics that came about through Mr. Labor's words were in response to Ms. Lawless's probing and were confined to that initial expression of, I wonder what it would
Emmett
be like.
Emmett told him to go back to his area. He
Correct.
Was out of the area.
He was angry at
Emmett, and he told Lawless, I would shoot Emmett first.
That
she took it to be a serious threat that he was going to be armed and shoot employees in that company.
First,
and that evidence went to the jury.
All of that is correct. But first, his statement—
How do you say that's not a threat?
Because his statement, again, is limited to the confines of that initial expression of, I wonder what it would be like. And Ms. Lawless's subjective interpretation—
It wasn't limited to that. It went beyond that. If he had done that, you may have a position. But he took it further. And he explained why he would shoot Emmett and Nona was the other individual he was going to shoot. Because he was corrected by her. And then he talked about bombing. And as the Chief Justice pointed out, he said, I'd start in the front office. And she took that to be a threat. And it was a threat. And he said it.
There's two points to be taken here. The first we've gone through. It's within the confines of his initial statement of wondering what it would be like.
Well, that was his initial statement. You're correct about that, but he transcended the initial statement.
He added more, but he did not take it outside of the expressing wonder context. The second point that's very important here is Ms. Lawless's, as the recipient, her subjective interpretation does not satisfy the specific intent element. The Attorney General's position is that because she reasonably experienced fear from these statements, that the specific intent element is satisfied. But that's not true, because we know that human beings can reasonably experience fear through the unknown or through uncertainty. And that's what happened here. Ms. Lawless's response is appropriate. The employer's response is appropriate. The investigation is appropriate. What's not appropriate is the criminal conviction, because his expression of wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent acts and all of the details staying confined in the parameters of that do not demonstrate the specific intent to intimidate or coerce.
Well, he starts out with, I wonder what it'd be like to do this, but then, you know, obviously she did have a dialogue with him. I don't think that is a problem, that a coworker asks additional questions. But then he doesn't say, I wonder what it'd be like to shoot, you know, Nona. I wonder what it would be like to shoot, you know, the other fellow's name, or I wonder what it would be like to bomb the front desk. He says emphatically, I would shoot, I would start with him, then I would do, you know, shoot her. I would start at the front desk with, or front office with a bomb. So it's not, I wonder what it would be like to bomb the front office. These are emphatic statements that this is what I would do. And the discussion that was elicited by the coworker actually gave rise to her reasonable expectation of fear that this was going to be an imminent act of violence on behalf of your client. You don't agree with that?
I don't disagree that the A2 element, that she has a reasonable experience of fear, is satisfied. We concede that. But that's not the same as the specific intent element. And regarding the specifics that he gives, we absolutely concede that he provides specifics. But Ms. Lawless's testimony, on whole, demonstrates that she understood it to be all within the confines of the expression of wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent acts. We ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and hold that an expression of mere wonder is not a terrorist threat under Ohio statute because it does not demonstrate the specific intent to intimidate or coerce.
Did he have the means to carry this out?
The record doesn't demonstrate it. We don't know.
Well, it's a, you know, in the Court of Appeals opinion, Judge Abel says Lawless, appellant continued that he thought of shooting two co-workers and that he had three bombs and would start at the front office. So he told her he had three bombs.
Again, those are specifics that were provided within the confines of
okay,
that wondering
what
it would
be like. Okay, so it's a little different than to say to, if I'm sitting on the jury and the evidence that's coming in is, not only do I think about doing this, not only do I have a specific plan, which I'm articulating upon probing to my coworker, but I also have the means to do this. I know what instrumentalities I would use. In fact, I have three bombs.
Correct. And if this court views those specifics to take it outside the context of expressing wonder, again, Mr. Labor loses. However, Ms. Lawless's testimony is unequivocal. He's only expressing wondering what it would be like, and then he provides admittedly alarming, disturbing details within this cordial give and take. Nonetheless, the expression of wonder alone is not threatening, and it does not demonstrate the specific intent to intimidate or coerce.
You don't think the possession of three bombs is...
I think that it rightfully creates alarm and that, again, Ms. Lawless's actions were appropriate. But under the specific element, which due process requires this court to evaluate whether that element was satisfied, and because of Ms. Lawless's unequivocal testimony, we do not believe that element was satisfied.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Jarosz?
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. The jury in this case reasonably concluded that David Labor had committed a terroristic threat, and that reasonable conclusion is supported by sufficient evidence. I'd like to briefly revisit the testimony, Linda Lawless's testimony, about what appellant said. He approached her in the hallway, and he said, "Have you ever thought about shooting this place up?" "No, I've never thought about that." "I have, and I would start with this person who I've come into conflict with." "Have you ever thought about bombing this place?" "No, I haven't." "I have. I would use three bombs. I would focus on the front office." He had come into conflict with people in the front office. Linda Lawless further testified about David Labor's demeanor as he said these things. She spoke about the look in his eye, the way he spoke, his standing position as he said these things to her. She also said that, in her opinion, he had a violent intent. All of these things are pieces of evidence that the jury was presented with based on Linda Lawless's testimony.
Did he say he had three bombs?
I recognize that the Fourth District, in its opinion, did say that he had three bombs. My review of the trial transcript in candor does not reveal that he said or that Linda Lawless said he actually had bombs, but that he would use three bombs and he would put them near the front office. Given that Linda Lawless testified about all of these things, and that she further testified that she felt fear based on these, and she also testified about the results of this threat. There was a great deal of testimony about the effects that this threat had, and in fact, one of the main reasons to criminalize threats is to prevent the negative results of a threat. In this case, the factory went on lockdown. They followed David Labor until he left the premises. They subsequently fired him. They tripled their security. They told everyone who was there that if they saw him, notify security or their supervisor immediately. All of these things support the idea that David Labor said these things that naturally had these effects with the intent to put the population at
Counsel, what's the legal standard for the jury to weigh a threat here? Is it the subjective fear of the person who heard the threat, or is it the reasonable person standard as viewed by the jury?
Well, this statute, Justice O'Neill, has two perspectives. First, it does require a subjective intent to put people in fear on the part of the speaker. And second, it requires both that it does put people in fear and that it reasonably does so. And that would be subsection 2, that as a result of the threat, the person causes a fear and that fear be reasonable. So it's both subjective and objective on the part of the recipient of the threat, and it's subjective on the part of the speaker.
And then when you talk about the subjective intent to put people in fear, you're saying it's the actual language used itself that that should be determinative?
Well, language is not the only piece of evidence in this case.
Because that's what opposing counsel is suggesting, that really this was speculation and his language was in the context of wondering and just making conversation, as it were.
Yes, Justice Lanziger. I'd like to consider briefly what the world would look like under that perspective. If a speaker could absolve himself of making a terroristic threat by using a specific type of language, oftentimes intending to make a threat, he would do so. Here, using a specific tense, using language that by terms is not saying I will do this, but I would do this, does not make it not a threat, does not mean he was not intending to make a threat. Whether or not it was a threat, whether or not he intended it to be a threat, is a matter for the jury. The language is one piece of evidence, and it's a strong piece in this case regarding his intent. Another piece of evidence is the demeanor evidence presented by Linda Lawless, who received the threat, what he was like when he was speaking this threat to her.
So we don't have to have a separate, say, act or means that would show he in fact did have three bombs. That's not needed to show specific intent, you're saying?
It is not needed. In this case, the act is the speech. There is no requirement, and in fact, subsection B of the statute specifically says that it is not a requirement that the speaker be able to or intend to actually carry out the act that is threatened.
So this is in the nature of speech that's crying fire in a crowded theater? I mean, we're taking it one step further and saying it can support a 3-year prison sentence.
That's right. So shouting fire in a crowded theater is one type of speech that is not protected by the First Amendment to the extent that states may criminalize it. This is a different type of speech that states may constitutionally criminalize. That's a true threat. And the Supreme Court has long held that true threats are a type of speech that states may criminalize.
But the Fourth District has that constitutional question in front of them now, is that right?
That's right, Justice French.
So you're not asking us to address the First Amendment question?
I'm asking you not to address the First Amendment question. I'd like you to await the Fourth District's opinion. Should either party in this case find that decision wanting, we may appeal to this court, and you'll have the opportunity to visit it then.
Wasn't there some testimony from Lawless that he said he could bomb it like they did in Colorado?
Yes. This took place a number of weeks after the shooting in an Aurora, Colorado theater, and Linda Lawless testified that he said to her he could bomb it like they did in Colorado. So it appears that statement was invoking...
That wasn't a thought.
I'm sorry?
That wasn't a thought. That was an expression of what could be done, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. He was saying, I could bomb it like they did in Colorado.
Thank you.
That gives further context to the type of threat that he was making. It makes it further seem, and it supports the jury's interpretation of Linda Lawless's testimony, that what was going on here was a threat, and that David Labor intended to threaten the workplace population. There are no further questions. I thank you. I ask you to affirm the Fourth District Court of Appeals and find that sufficient evidence supports the verdict.
Counsel, you've used a little over 2 minutes. You've left a little over 2 minutes.
Okay.
Counsel, I've listened to all of this, and I'm still stuck on Justice French's first question. The evidence went to the jury, and you're not suggesting that inadmissible evidence was presented, are you? Or you're just talking about the sufficiency?
That's correct. This is a sufficiency challenge, like that in Straley, Malone, and Smith, in which Mr. Labor asked this court to set the parameters for the type of evidence that can establish the specific intent to intimidate or coerce. I'd like to quickly address one aspect of the record presentation here. Mr. Labor did not approach Ms. Lawless. He was standing in the hallway, and Ms. Lawless was coming from the bathroom, and she approached him. That's neither here nor there in terms of the legal question before the court, but it is the facts.
What more would he have had to say if you say that what was presented to the jury was insufficient to allow them to convict according to the statute? Now, you don't have a problem with the wording of the statute. You just think that the evidence was insufficient to support the jury conviction, correct?
Yes, this is a sufficiency challenge.
All right. So what more would he have had to say to Ms. Lawless, in your mind, to be presented to the jury to support this verdict?
He would have had to have said something that took it outside of the confines of wondering what it would be like. In Bauman, the Sixth District dealt with language that said, I want to kill, I have an insatiable desire and thirst to kill. In Hansen, the court dealt with language that said, if something doesn't get done, I will do it. Those are examples. And really, in a hypothetical world, any statement that would take it outside of the context of purely wondering what it would be like to commit certain violent acts would satisfy that. I acknowledge that there are a lot of specifics that go on here.
Testimony that this could be done like the way they did it in Colorado?
I don't know that, I do not believe that the words were precisely that. However, yes, the Colorado theater is referenced. And even if he said it could happen like it did in Colorado, Ms. Lawless's testimony is unequivocal that throughout all of it, he's expressing wondering what it would be like to commit these violent acts. Another aspect at play here, although only tangentially relevant, is that Ms. Lawless's testimony demonstrates that Mr. Labor, at this time that this conversation happens, is going through, at a minimum, a period of mental instability. A lot of her descriptions of him demonstrate that she calls him out there, not here with me, not within the same reality.
Isn't that worse? I mean, isn't it worse if he's mentally unstable?
I don't believe so, because if he is mentally unstable, I don't believe a schizophrenic or someone to that effect can formulate the specific intent to intimidate. Now, of course, there were words.
Was there the insanity defense here?
No, and I'm not trying to imply that this case can be decided on a mental health issue, just like I'm not trying to imply that this case can be decided on the First Amendment. This is not a First Amendment case. This is not a mental health issue case. However, it's all relevant in terms of what was presented to the jury and in this court's evaluation of the statutory elements and what evidence can constitute.
Sufficiency is not a challenge to manifest weight determined by a jury. sufficiency is a legal question that's determined by a court before the case gets to a jury. Now, are you arguing manifest weight or sufficiency?
Sufficiency. I'm asking
you wanted the court to direct a verdict in this case before it ever got to a jury.
Had the court
been requested? Is that right or not?
Had the court been requested to do so, yes. And the reason why is because...
Well, then, is it an error that there was no motion like that at trial?
It may have been, but that's irrelevant to this court's evaluation because courts of appeals make sufficiency determinations all the time. And as this court has done, this court makes statutory interpretations that impact sufficiency analysis in that it sets parameters for the types of evidence that can fulfill elements of certain crimes. Again, the Straley, Malone, and Smith examples are at play here, and that's what we ask this court to do in this specific context.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshal, will you call a recess, please?